Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
As the protests at Standing Rock, North Dakota continue against the nearly 1,200-mile-long Dakota Access Pipeline that runs from oil fields in northwestern North Dakota to Illinois, tensions between law enforcement and activists have escalated. The protesters, who include members of over 500 Native American tribes, have gathered to protest to protect water resources and sacred cultural sites. Last week, the Army Corps of Engineers issued an eviction notice ordering them to evacuate federal lands by December 5th. Joining us now to talk about the situation and the future of the No DAPL movement are Oscar-nominated filmmaker Josh Fox, creator of the Gasland series and his most recent film, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. And also joining us soon, Dallas Goldtooth, a member of the Mde Wa Kan Tan Dakota and Diné tribes, and the Keystone XL campaign organizer for the Indigenous Environmental Network. I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show now. Well, hello, Josh.
Thanks, Leonard. It's great to be back.
You've just returned from your second trip to Standing Rock. How have the protests changed since your first visit?
Well, it's a lot colder, and the police have really ramped up their tactics. So I think there is a great deal of vigilance on the ground. I mean, Thanksgiving was an unbelievable weekend. Of course, the tribes don't call it Thanksgiving. They call it Thanksgiving. They call it Survivor's Day. It's a day of mourning, not a day of celebration, because the myth of Thanksgiving obviously is a lie, and that Thanksgiving was actually a massacre. And this fact is not lost on the tribes, who are going to their native burial grounds and finding rows and rows of riot gear, militarized police up on top of their burial grounds. I was part of a protest on Thanksgiving Day where you had literally hundreds of water protectors. They're not called protesters because protester is a colonized word. They're water protectors going across the Cannonball River to the burial grounds on the sort of lip and the banks where I witnessed weeks earlier police shooting rubber bullets, pepper spraying, macing peaceful, unarmed protesters directly in the face with no provocation. And there you are staring down this huge line of riot police. And me as a member of the press, and also I would say part of the action, you know, you're taking your life in your own hands at that point, because just a week ago, the police shot rubber bullets and hosed down with water cannons protesters at 20-degree weather, which is, according to the United Nations, lethal force, because you cannot expose someone to instant hypothermia like that. And one of the protectors, Sophia Wolanski, who's actually from New York, I think she's from Brooklyn, she had a concussion grenade hurled at her arm, and it blew up, and it shattered her arm. It ripped it to shreds. She's still in surgery, I believe, a week later, so she doesn't lose that arm. But had it hit her in the neck or in the head, there's no question she would have died from that injury.
Although that has been disputed by the police there.
Well, let's be absolutely clear about this. The Morton County Sheriff's Department is not telling the truth. In fact, they are lying. They are lying through their teeth. I was standing next to my colleague, Aaron Schrody, who's a CNN correspondent, works for ABC News, was the youngest congressional candidate in the history of California. She was shot in the back with a rubber bullet while she was conducting an interview. I heard the shot. She was standing right next to me. The Morton County Sheriff's Department insists that this never happened. The Morton County Sheriff's Department insists that they were using water cannons to put out fires that were lit by protectors. This is all fiction, and it is a serious crisis when law enforcement simply does not tell even a speck of truth, one iota of the truth, then law enforcement, in fact, becomes lawlessness and breaks down at the very fundamental level.
Dallas, how many people have been arrested so far?
You know, we've had, right now, I think the number is over 450 active cases, well, pushing up near 500 arrests. You know, and all those arrests have been ranging from, you know, for a crazy amount of accusations. You know, that designating our folks as rioters, even though we're peaceful, peaceful marches, stating that we put police in danger for locking ourselves to equipment. It's just a ludicrous escalation and excessive use of force by police, and just really it's absurd. So, you know, we a lot of those cases are being thrown out into the courts once they get to before the judges. You know, there's a lot of charges of felonies, and a lot of them have been dismissed. Just recently, there was a dismissal of some charges against a young Native woman called Red Fawn, who was charged with discharging of a weapon, potentially, you know, shooting towards police officers. But there's not enough evidence, and they have to throw those charges out. And now all that's left is a remaining charge, a federal charge of possession of a firearm by a felon.
Isn't there a blizzard there right now?
It is. I am literally in a yurt on top of a hill with 40 mile an hour winds outside, and it's not too cold. It's about 30 degrees right now, which is not too cold for North Dakota. But it is a blizzard that's been going since yesterday. It's supposed to go through tomorrow. There are 3-foot snow drifts all over the place. But people are warm. People are. We've done a good job of making sure our people are taken care of, and that we have heated spaces for everybody.
How long have you been involved in organizing for the Indigenous Environmental Network? Has it interfered with your other career as a comedian?
It's actually has given me some amazing, amazing material for comedic fodder. You know, I think that I've been working with the Indigenous Environmental Network for about 3 years. I first came on in the amazing fight against Keystone XL in supporting actually the same communities. These are the same people, the Dakota, Lakota, Nakota people of the Ocheti Shakoni, who fought and defeated the Keystone XL pipeline, who are now fighting against Dakota Access. So, you know, I've had an amazing experience being with IEN and working with frontline Indigenous communities all across Turtle Island, which is also known as so-called North America. So it's been really great.
Josh, how did you become involved with the protests?
I was actually invited by Shailene Woodley to participate in a march at Union Square in New York City. The Youth Council of Standing Rock are the people who started this movement. They're young kids who are very upset about the climate implications and the environmental and water implications, and most of all, the Indigenous sovereignty implications of having a major oil pipeline go underneath their major watershed. Shailene and I became good friends when we were working on the Bernie Sanders campaign. We were both Bernie Sanders surrogates. And a lot of the Standing Rock movement, I think, picks up where Bernie Sanders' campaign left off. So these kids ran all the way from North Dakota to Washington, D.C. to make their point to President Obama. They arrived in New York. We had a rally there. And even though they were 4 hours late, people stayed and waited for them, and the rally went on. And that's when I knew something really, really special was happening. Since then, the Standing Rock camp has swelled, like I said, over Thanksgiving to 15,000 people.
And hasn't one of your colleagues, Daya Schlossberg, who produced your latest film, arrested last month, charged with felonies that might mean decades of jail time because she was filming the civil disobedience?
Yeah, reporters are being targeted. They're being harassed. Amy Goodman was charged with criminal trespass for doing her job as a reporter. Aaron Schrody, like I said, shot in the back. Shailene herself was arrested for live streaming when she had a 40,000-person audience. And yes, Daya Schlossberg, in another part of North Dakota, in a solidarity action called Keep It in the Ground, where activists were shutting down oil sands pipelines, she was thrown in jail for 53 hours straight, and then charged with felonies that would have brought her 45 years. Thankfully, and this is an update that just happened, that North Dakota has settled that case and is throwing that out because it's ludicrous. As Dallas said, a lot of this is intimidation tactics. What's not intimidation tactics, however, is sheer intimidation, but is actual violence, is the way the police in Morton County are behaving towards unarmed protesters. It's frankly a disaster. Cory Booker, Bernie Sanders, 20 members of Congress have called upon President Obama to please bring in the Department of Justice. This is a situation analogous to what we saw in Mississippi and Alabama when freedom riders were being thrown in jail in the civil rights movement and harassed and beaten by a racist police force backed up by racist governors. That is what's happening in North Dakota, and we cannot stand for it.
Now, Dallas, isn't this movement being led by Native Americans? What's the significance of that and the message, keep it in the ground?
You know, this movement is indigenous-led. I mean, this movement, as a lot of the significant moments in the recent climate justice movement within the past 10 years, you know, has been led by indigenous peoples or by frontline communities, you know, poor communities who are on the frontline fight, whether it's at the extraction point of fossil fuel development or at the refinement or during these infrastructure projects, these transportation projects, just like this pipeline. You know, this is all connected to the greater Keep It in the Ground movement, which is really a major push for us to really properly address climate change in the most direct way as possible, which is, you know, to seek a moratorium on new fossil fuel development and to see the closure of current fossil fuel development for the benefit of all of us. And it just so happens that a lot of these major places where these critical fights are happening are on or adjacent to indigenous, currently occupied indigenous territories, whether it's in Alaska or it's in the Gulf Coast or it's in the American Southwest or in the Powder River Basin, or if it's in the Bakken oil shale where the Dakota Access oil is coming from. You know, this is just, we had a huge win in the fight against Keystone XL, and the only way that was, one of the major parts of that win was the voices, the stories, and the heart of the Native people who are just defending the protection of their water, defending the protection of the land, and defending their rights as indigenous peoples to decide for themselves what happens to the land, what happens to their water, what happens to their bodies. And, you know, so this is all a part of a greater pushback against a system that's predicated upon the oppression of our people and the advancement of fossil fuels in a time when we need the opposite. So it's a pretty powerful time right now. And also, I just want to say, like, yes, the youth are an amazing part of this, and they've always led in this effort. And they continue to, Native youth are continuing to step up to speak on their own behalf and for future generations.
I'm speaking with Dallas Goldtooth, who's a Keystone XL campaign organizer for the Indigenous Environmental Network, and with filmmaker Josh Fox, reporting from Standing Rock. Josh, the pipeline is being developed by Dakota Access LLC, a subsidiary of the Dallas, Texas Corporation Energy Transfer Partners. How did they determine the route of the pipeline? Wasn't it originally planned to go through Bismarck,
well,
North
yes.
Dakota?
Interestingly enough, the pipeline was originally supposed to go through predominantly white Bismarck. The people in Bismarck complained about that. So our Army Corps of Engineers, which is basically an organization that is controlled by the president, decided to reroute it through Native American territory, which is a fine part of our environmental racist traditions in the United States of America. So what this became was an issue not only and through their only watershed. And it's clear that pressure has to be put right now on Barack Obama, because where this stands, there is a crucial permit that the pipeline company lacks to drill underneath the water. Army Corps has not granted that permit yet. We would like to see Barack Obama deny that permit to the Dakota Access Pipeline Company, because as you know, these pipelines leak with incredible frequency and with devastating effects. The Yellowstone River, the Kalamazoo River, the beaches of Santa Barbara, Mayflower, Arkansas. I could rattle off to you hundreds of oil spills.
Well, there were two very recent ones in Alabama. The pipeline delivery system, on Halloween, an explosion along the Colonial Pipeline, that accident was six of the year in Alabama for the company that owns it. But don't Indians have sovereignty over their own land? How did this pipeline wind up on Indian territory?
Yeah, one thing, just to jump on that last question, one thing that folks don't know, so Energy Transfer Partners, the Dakota Access is a subsidiary of that, and they're charged with the construction of it. But the operation of the pipeline is going to another subsidiary, Sunoco Sunoco Corporation, which has the worst track record of any of all pipeline companies for most amount of leaks in the past 10 years. Like, that is on paper, that they are, have the worst record for having the most leaks. So that's just, it adds to the absurdity. But, you know, as far as...
Sorry, Dallas, go ahead. Sorry.
In the United States. And the, you know, the way the routing is right now is technically it's routed. The pipeline is proposed to go just 4 miles north of the tribe of the reservation, of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. But it is within our traditional treaty territory, which was in the Treaty of 1851, the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1851, designated this entire area as our land, or was negotiated that this would be our land. And that, on our side, that treaty was never nullified. It was never voided. That's still standing. So, from the perspective of the state of North Dakota and from the perspective of the Army Corps of Engineers, they're saying, well, technically, it's all off the reservation, so you have limited ability to comment on this issue. We have a right. There is federal policy that a project like this, that tribes have to be consulted. But what happened was Dakota Access and the state and local permitting agencies created the route, came up with all the plans, drew up all the designs, all the paperwork, and got all the started getting the permitting process for the state in place. And then they went to the tribe and said, hey, we want to talk, consult with you on this project. That's not consultation. Consultation is not when the enemy is knocking at your doors, when the company is the company's bulldozers are right outside your doorstep. Consultation happens at the very beginning. And that's the crux. That is the very focal point of the tribal's legal arguments in this case, is that they're breaking federal law. They broke federal law, mm-hmm. went against federal policy of having adequate, proper tribal consultation on a project that would impact the drinking water of their of this nation, that would impact sacred sites and cultural sites all along the proposed route, that the tribes numerous times spoke up and said they were there and they were not heard. And there's this ongoing myth that the tribes had ample had opportunity to speak up against this pipeline and they never did. There is documentation that Dakota Access in North Dakota went to the tribe, made a presentation October 2014, and the tribe said, this is not, we do not approve of this pipeline. So there, you know, the tribe has always been against this pipeline and continues to stand its ground.
Why have other tribes joined the Standing Rock Sioux in this movement?
Oh, that's the beautiful part of this. It's actually, we are seeing the largest mobilization of tribal unity across North America in generations, for years and years and generations, that we have right now over of the 365 tribal nations in the United States, 320 of them have all sent a formal declaration of support, have sent letters to the White House asking for the White House to hear what the tribal's concerns and to stop this pipeline. And this that's just for the United States. There are an extra 300 tribes up in, or 250 tribes in Canada who have stated the very same in support of Standing Rock. There's a federal lawsuit the tribe has filed against the Army Corps of Engineers based on the arguments I presented earlier. And a number of other tribes downriver, the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, who's just on the southern border of the Standing Rock Rez, is also on the Missouri River. They've joined that lawsuit. The Yankton Sioux Tribe, which is farther downriver, has also filed its own is also in the current process of filing its own lawsuit against the United States government. So that's the beautiful part of this whole thing, is that it has really brought together quote unquote Indian country. Like, people have stood up like we have never seen before. And it's really, really amazing thing to see.
Isn't it often argued that projects like this bring income into the Indian reservations?
It could be. But actually, one thing is a really good, really amazing statistic that we just learned here is that since this whole fight has started, crime all across the reservation has dropped. Like, crazy. There is there have been, like, more or less, there have been no violent crimes in the past 6 months. Like, one major issue in Indian country is a very serious issue, is suicide and a lot of depression amongst young folks. And this, the Standing Rock had actually was going through some really, really tough times dealing with youth suicide and teen suicide. And those numbers have completely dropped to zero.
Do you think
since this has happened?
Dallas, do you think that's because the protest camp itself is such an amazing, beautiful place, and that people have found this incredible meaning in this struggle and reconnected with the sort of spirituality of this that's at the core of this movement? Do you credit that?
Oh yeah, I think that the amazing part of us is that we're demonstrating what we're fighting against, which is this pipeline in the system that has created these structures that go through a lot of vulnerable and impacted communities. But we're also demonstrating what we're fighting for.
In contrast, officials at the Morton County Sheriff's Office have described the demonstration as an ongoing riot, and they've released photos that they say show protesters allegedly setting fires and using aggressive tactics while trying to dismantle a police barricade on Backwater Bridge.
Can I address this? That's insane, and that is a blatant lie. The Morton County Sheriff's Department, for what I've seen with my own eyes, are people who stand in front of them and say, "We are praying for you. We love you," without aggression. And they're being maced and they're being pepper sprayed and they're being treated with unbelievable aggression. In fact, I have documented this on video. I've put out videos through Now This, and I'm coming out with one in Rolling Stone later today that shows exactly what happens. The Morton County Sheriff's Department is saying, these are rioters. That's crazy to me. I am committed to Standing Rock because when I got there and when I went to Ochetisakoan, the main camp there, I was so unbelievably moved by watching a self-organizing community that is built on generosity, that's built on ceremony and prayer, that's built on helping your fellow man and woman, and the incredible amount of respect that you live and breathe on that camp for the water, for the air, for democracy, for human rights, for each other. And to be characterized as rioters, one can only assume that the Morton County Sheriff Department are the ideological and genealogical descendants of General Custer. And this evacuation notice from the Army Corps of Engineers actually happens to fall on Custer's birthday. Aspect of this, and it happened on the day after Thanksgiving. It's as if we haven't learned anything from the 500 years of genocidal history against Native Americans. It is appalling. And as a journalist, for the police department to be quoted is often one of those things that you must do. But what happens if the police department is completely blatantly lying? Well, they've lost all credibility, and that is why it's so important that independent journalists have been putting their lives on the line to get these stories and get these pictures, which so obviously contradict the Morton County Sheriff's Department.
Dallas, is this particularly a Dakotan thing? An environmental officer from one of the local tribes said recently that North Dakota and South Dakota fight over who can be more mean to the Native Americans.
There has been an incredibly appalling track record in North Dakota and South Dakota of systemic racism all across the board. I mean, in South Dakota, North Dakota, as well as neighboring Minnesota, Native folks make up actually a slim percentage of the population, but we're occupying 20% to 30% of the jails and prisons. I mean, that is a great example of the systemic racism that we're faced against. We are not blind to the oppression that we see here. It is part of a common day experience. So, for us, is this, what we're seeing with Morton County and the verbiage that they're using, the language that they're using, merely to legitimize the violent oppression, the usage of weapons upon our peaceful protesters is appalling, yes. Disgusting, yes. But is it surprising? No. This is just a snapshot of what a lot of our communities have to deal with. And so, we continue to advocate. And the beautiful part about this is because of this fight, it's exposing a lot of that systemic racism that we're pushing against. And it has brought together an amazing array of people from all walks of life, from different colors and creeds, to this space to stand in solidarity on this issue. And so, like, that's the beautiful part that I really see coming out of this.
And this is why we're calling on Obama and the Department of Justice to step in. And we're going to be doing that. And I don't know if you know this yet, Dallas, but our good friend Jane Kleben, Bold, the Bold Alliance, is calling for an occupation of the National Mall on December 12th. We are going to be bringing teepees down there. We're going to be calling for a protest camp at the National Mall in Washington, D.C. So stay tuned to theboldalliance.org to find out more details about that. A protest camp like Ocheti Sakoen shouldn't be just in North Dakota. We should make one in Washington to remind Barack Obama that he has a civic responsibility towards human rights and democracy in America.
President-elect Donald Trump holds stock in the company that's building the disputed Dakota Access Oil Pipeline. Has he commented on the situation? Do either of you know?
Go ahead, Josh.
Not that I know of. He's been obviously very, very aggressive in promoting fossil fuels. And this is a big, big thing that's hanging over the entire protest. However, Barack Obama can do something now. He can't simply hide behind, oh, Trump will reverse any decision. You know, that's operating out of fear. You need to operate out of what's going to be, what needs to happen, what needs to happen right now. It would be such an incredible obliteration of his human rights legacy, of his legacy on Native American lands and Native American territory to not stand up right now. So, of course, Trump has been incredibly aggressive. One thing that I worry about is the violence that Donald Trump has encouraged at his rallies, and that same violence being mirrored in a police department, which clearly is operating with lawlessness. This police department, they do not identify themselves. They don't have name badges. So when you see an officer throw a concussion grenade, you don't know the name of that officer. That, to me, is illegal. They have blockaded North Dakota 1806, which is the primary artery from the Ocheti Sakoen camp to Bismarck, which impedes ambulances and adds travel time to anyone who's seriously injured, and that was a factor in Sophia Wilansky's case as well.
And we have very little time left, but I just want to ask about what's happened recently. Last week, the Army Corps of Engineers ordered that public access to Ocheti Sakoen camp be closed on December 5th and ordered the eviction of the protesters. And North Dakota Governor Jack Dalrymple just filed an executive order yesterday to remove activists from that camp. Has there been any support from local politicians or government officials?
There has been, you know, so to clarify, the Army Corps did file and state that they are asking folks to move, and what we've through further clarification with the Army Corps, that was done so that they have no legal liabilities should something happen. I mean, and also I see it as a passing of the buck to the state of North Dakota to do whatever they want to do, to continue this reign of violence that they've been placing our people in. And I think that, you know, Dalrymple's executive order, there have been a number of state agencies who have stated that they are not planning to act upon that executive order. But it's still concerning that at any point he could call in the National Guard and using state police to do a sweep of this camp. There have been there's been an amazing wave of support. We've had everyone from Bernie Sanders to Keith Ellison. We've had a number of other folks who have stood up and have called for basically for President Obama to step in and to continue to put pressure on this White House administration to keep to its commitments to indigenous peoples, but then also to keep to its commitments to address climate change. So, you know, we are continuing to be here. This coming weekend, there's over 2,000 veterans all across the United States who are coming to camp to stand in solidarity. It's going to be amazing a day on December 5th. We, as a camp, are not moving. We are sticking to our position that we are on treaty rights. This is our land, and we are not going to some other folks have stated, is that, you know, it's absurd for us in 2016 to be faced with a threat of being removed from our own land just as much as just like our ancestors did.
Dallas so Goldtooth is the Keystone XL campaign organizer for the Indigenous Environmental Network and a comedian, and Josh Fox is a filmmaker. His latest is How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much, Leonard, for covering this.
Alexander Pushkin has been called the father of Russian literature, and yet there's never been a full modern English translation of all of his prose. That is, of course, until now. The latest work of translators Richard Prevere and Larisa Volokhansky is the complete Novels, Tales, and Journeys of Alexander Pushkin, published by Knopf. The translators have been awarded the Penn Book of the Month Club Translation Prize twice, and I'm delighted to welcome them back to our show now. Hello.
Hello. Very good
Hello.
To be here again.
Thank you for having us.
One of you is a poet. The other studied mathematical linguistics and theology. How did you end up translating the Russian canon?
Well, I was very interested in Russian literature, and then I married a Russian woman, and then we were once simultaneously reading the same book, and my wife kept saying, how did they translate this? Because I didn't know Russian. And she would look and see, I see they didn't translate it.
Which book are we talking about?
This was The Brothers Karamazov, our
first book. It was 30 years ago.
So I suddenly, this little light went on in my head. I thought, what did they leave out? You know, and I discovered they left out a whole dimension of his work then.
And you, the last time you were here, we talked about your process, which seems to be that Larisa does a literal translation and then hands it to you, and you say, no, no, and then the two of you have to fight over what gets in and what doesn't get in.
We never fight.
Oh, sorry.
We illuminate.
Come to an agreement.
We illuminate each other.
We discuss. We discuss. I try to make my translation as close to the original as possible with all kinds of pointing out the nuances, the irregularity, the interesting syntax, interesting word, there's some slang word, and then Richard takes...
Or mixed cliches or modified cliches. It looks like a cliche but isn't.
But then you also have to capture the spirit of the
exactly,
language.
Yeah.
The voice of the original.
This is a sort of mystical thing. It's very hard to define what that is.
You've translated Dostoevsky, Chekhov, Tolstoy, writers who are fairly well known to English readers. But that's not really the case with Pushkin. Is it because he's best known as a great poet and poetry is difficult to translate from Russian to English?
Well, it is partly that, yes. He's, it's difficult, and yet, look, his masterpiece, Yevgeny Onegin, has recently been translated maybe five or six times by different poets in rhyming versions, and so they keep trying, they keep doing it.
But it seems like most of these books defy translation. What's the problem in translating Russian into English? The Russians, I've had Russians tell me that Shakespeare is much better in Russian than he is in English.
Yeah, they improve it, yeah.
No, no, it's not that. Actually, I think that poetry most of the time is untranslatable, really good. The languages are really different. You
know, every language, would French poetry translate better into English than Russian poetry?
No.
No.
It's all difficult.
Yeah.
No, Pushkin's poetry is so perfect. It's so bound to the Russian language that when it's transposed into English language, it may be the same rhythm, the same rhyme, the same, like, Onegin's stanza, which is very complex, very hard to convey. It's still not Pushkin. When we read Pushkin, is perfect. And you can't translate perfection.
So what about the prose?
Yes, the prose. The interesting thing with Pushkin was he said he based his prose work very, very consciously. Although he wrote poetry by inspiration, he worked on prose very consciously, and he kept saying, prose is the opposite of poetry. And he made his prose as unpoetic as he could. And it's stylistically, the great thing in it is it's a perfect simplicity of wording.
and terseness. His prose is very terse. There you can't take away anything, you can't add anything, because actually it's very interesting, this early 19th century French translators of Pushkin, Mérimée translated Pushkin's prose. He added things to it. He embellished it because to his mind, he was too simple.
The Soviet poet Yevgeny Yevtushenko, I guess the former Soviet, and he's still alive, once wrote that translation is like a woman. If it's beautiful, it's not faithful. If it's faithful, it is most certainly not beautiful.
Well, that's a nice phrase. You know, you can do the real benefit of translation to the language of arrival is doing new things in English that are new because you're translating from Russian. They have to be rather natural sounding, but at the same time, the translating, the act of translating, enriches the language that of arrival, the English, in other words. This quality of Pushkin's prose, which is a sort of classical prose written in Romantic period, you know, is very instructive for English writers, I think.
He wrote before the other people you've translated.
Yes. He was really the history of Russian language and the formation of the Russian literary language, let's say, was very recent compared to English or French or German. It really was Pushkin who created the literary language of Russia, both in poetry and in prose.
So did he influence Dostoevsky, Tolstoy,
absolutely,
Chekhov?
Absolutely, yeah, and Gogol. He knew Gogol.
He even gave him the topic of the dead souls.
And the nose, yes.
Sales of Anna Karenina skyrocketed after Oprah chose your translation for her book club. Do you remember that moment and how you felt about it? Louisa, I've heard that you hadn't heard of Oprah before she chose the book.
No. We got the phone call at our editor at Knopf, at Random House.
Penguin, excuse me.
It was Penguin, right.
Our editor
called us and said, I only heard Richard's, our side of the conversation. I heard Richard say, 900,000 copies. I said, 900,000 copies of what? And Richard said, of Anna Karenina. I said, why, what's that? And he said, Oprah, and I had no idea who Oprah was.
Well, no, our editor called and said, I loved telling you guys this because you won't understand it. And I said, well, try. And she said, who is Oprah Winfrey? And I said, I think she's a country western singer.
Well, sales had been around 20,000 previous translations.
Yeah, they had done pretty well. Well, Anna did pretty well, too.
Well, Anna Karenina is a book that's been read by millions over the years in many different translations. So have any number of novels by Dostoevsky. Mm-hmm. Why do we have to keep on translating them? In the case of Pushkin, he hasn't been translated as much.
Not as much, but although when you start looking, you find that he has been, but they don't notice it so much. Tolstoy and Dostoevsky really entered into Western literature from way back, almost from the time when they were still writing. But why translate? Well, it's the thing is that there's one original, and then each generation enters into a relation to that original, and you start seeing differently or hearing differently. You see different things. And it doesn't mean that you change the book, but you change some sort of emphasis in your own the language.
There is this dialogue with the present-day culture.
Which is a very healthy thing.
But also, I think that ideal translations don't exist. Good translations exist and may even live for a very long time, but ideal translations don't exist. And if the book keeps getting retranslated, it's a test. It testifies to the interest. It means that the text is alive. The people, people want to read it and want to read it again and again.
So when we return to a favorite book that's been translated, should we just go to a different translation each time?
Well, I think there are two ways to do that. We were just talking about that on the way here. That one thing, I know that when I read something in a translated from a language I don't know, I tend to hold on to the first translation that I've read, because if it affects me, it affects me strongly, and that effect is connected with that translation.
And many people remember Dostoevsky from his first translator, mm-hmm. who wrote wonderful English prose.
Yeah.
Now I've forgotten her name. Is that Garnett,
her? Constance Garnett.
Yeah, Constance Garnett.
Or Garnett, is how they say in England.
And but then many people came along and said, no, we have to fix it. We have to keep on doing it. Constance Garnett is the translation that most resonates in my mind. But mm-hmm. yeah. Did I not get everything?
Well, yeah, she translated very well. She's probably the best of all the original translators of these books. With Dostoevsky, and this is what we discovered when we were first reading together, there's a whole realm of art, of play, of joking with language, of stylistic humor, which she didn't understand. She just left it out. So that Americans and English readers have this idea of a dark, obsessed, morbid Dostoevsky, and they miss the fact that the style gives wings to it, brightens it, enlightens it completely. And this is what we discovered in translating him. It makes him look as if he's clumsy, because he never writes in his own voice. Tolstoy always wrote in his own voice, which is also can be rather crude and clumsy, but Dostoevsky always dramatizes his narrator as well as his character, so that there is no fixed authoritative point of view.
And it's been said that Constance Garnett is the reason that Americans can't tell the difference between Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. Yeah. Tolstoyevsky. In the case of Pushkin, now you have, are all of these pieces translated again, or have some of them, are some of them for the first time?
I don't know if some. Maybe.
No,
this is
these
complete prose works.
They all have been translated.
Some of the fragments. Probably
some
were
of
not.
Them were translated several times, and some of them were translated only once, like the Journey to Arzrum, which is a wonderful traveling notes by Pushkin, and the book is unavailable. Was translated many years ago and by Ardis Publishers, and is not available. We thought it was worth including it. Then some fragments that are very little known. We just wanted to collect them together under the same cover.
Under 500 pages, we have novels, tales, and journeys, mm-hmm. according to your title. So did he write brief novels?
Yes. Well, if you the only finished novel is The Captain's Daughter.
Mm-hmm.
It is an absolute masterpiece, but it's very short. It's 110 pages, I think. That's the longest thing he wrote, except for Onegin. But I don't know. Everyone who reviews it, I remember. There was a wonderful reviewer who wrote for Hudson Review named Marvin Mudrick, who picked it up in a collection of Pushkin's prose and read it. And he said, "My God, this is the best novel I've ever read." And it's very impressive that way. And yet it's absolutely simple. And his heroes are absolutely ordinary. That's the beauty of Pushkin.
Now, Larissa, you grew up, of course, reading Russian. So did you read all of these pieces by Pushkin just in the normal course of...
I was very young when I grew up with Pushkin. And it's very hard to explain what it is. I think the most important thing, not important, but it's impossible to explain what it is about him that makes us Russians love him so much. I think one of the qualities of his prose and poetry is its harmony. You know, when you read Pushkin, you are both, you laugh and you weep, and it makes you happy. And it's not because he portrays a happy world. His world has evil in it. His world has treason in it, cruelty, even wickedness. But somehow there is also light in it. It's about qualities that it's very hard to talk about. There is wisdom, there is honor, there is gratitude, there is mercy. It's all there, and it makes one, you read it and you are happy.
And then there's the musicality of the prose. When you are doing a translation, do you just try to do a musicality of English prose, or is there some way to capture the dusha, the Russian soul, in his work?
I try to capture that, yes, and even that's the most difficult thing to define and to capture. But I try to listen to what happens in the Russian, and I try to follow it. I try to see how it's brought about, how it's made to happen.
Well, in the case
of follow his words very carefully.
In the case of English to French or French to English, of course, we share many words. How many words do Russian and English share? Not too many?
Not too many. There are some Latin roots for some Russian words. But it's not that. It's the, I think the rhythm, the syntax of the prose, the simple phrases that Pushkin uses. Just as in Tolstoy, he sometimes, he has a, in War and Peace, there's one sentence that goes for two pages of perfectly rhetorical, suspended clauses. And he was very proud of that. He once said, I used every device in the old Latin grammars. So it wasn't unconscious. He did it on purpose.
There is another stylistic property to Pushkin's prose. It's very simple, but it's never banal. So when you translate it, you have to avoid temptation to fall into just flatness, to cliches. It's very simple, but it's very fresh. And it's not odd. It's not strange, like with Dostoevsky or Tolstoy. Very often, there is odd things happening. Not with Pushkin. It's ordinary, but it's not flat. It's somehow you have to make it.
It's completely alive.
Alive.
Well, you've given us the complete prose of Pushkin. There's still a lot of Tolstoy, for example, short fiction like Life and Death of Ivan Ilyich, Resurrection, etc., to be retranslated. Is that where you're going next?
We did Ivan Ilyich.
Ah,
we did a
one
collection.
Of my favorites.
Yeah. We did a collection of his short prose. I think we've done all of Tolstoy that we're going to do. We would like to do more Leskov, but since he's not known, people don't know him, and so it's very hard to get people interested in him.
Richard Pevere and Larisa Volchansky will be at the 92nd Street Y tomorrow night at 8, where they'll be answering questions and signing books. Then on Monday the 12th, they'll be at McNally-Jackson Bookstore at 52 Prince Street at 7 p.m. Their latest translation, Novels, Tales, Journeys of Alexander Pushkin from Knopf. Thank you both so much.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 2 months, Republicans will control much of federal and state government, the presidency, Congress, 32 state legislatures, 33 governorships, many federal and state courts, and soon the Supreme Court. As a result, the course of public policy is likely to be affected for decades. Democratic leaders and many others, including some Republicans, are asking what happened. In several essays for Vanity Fair, Columbia University economist and Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz has examined economic and political developments in the United States, and you can find a link to his most recent piece, How the Democrats Can Fix Themselves, on our show page at wnyc.org/lopate. I'm very pleased it has brought Joseph Stiglitz back to our show. Welcome back.
Nice to be here.
The Electoral College aside, do you have a favorite explanation for why the Democrats lost so widely when projections before the election suggested otherwise?
Well, I don't have a good explanation other than what you can read widely about why the polling was so bad. But I do have an explanation of what went wrong more generally. And what you know, it shouldn't have been even close. And you have to ask the question, why was it even so close? You know, Hillary did win more popular votes.
Up to over 2.5 million, it turns out now.
Exactly. So that highlights the fact that our electoral college system may be designed well for the 19th century, really doesn't make sense for the 21st century.
Well, I don't think they felt that way in the 19th century either. Samuel J. Tilden, I don't think, was all that happy about the electoral college. He won by a large majority of the vote and lost the election to Rutherford B. Hayes.
Yeah, this is a long, as you say, a long history of questioning our democracy in a way. You know, you have to have checks against the abuses of the majority of the minority. But you also need to have checks against the abuses of by the minority or the majority.
Do you see this election as an aberration, as a sign of specific political concerns like the Electoral College or the party system, or as a harbinger of long-term changes in the United States? Could we be undergoing a major long-term change?
Well, I think there are both long-term and short-term economic issues underlying the, you might say, the closeness, the division, and the anger that was so evident in this election. In particular, if you look back on what's been happening, and I've talked about this on this show, is that we've had growing inequality to the point where wages at the bottom are lower than at the level that they were 60 years ago, adjusted for inflation. The income, the median income, half above and half below, of a full-time male worker today is lower than it was, say, four decades ago. So all of these are economic forces. People ought to be unhappy.
But that trend has been bipartisan. It's occurred during both Democratic and Republican administrations.
Well, I think there were a couple things that you might say tipped the balance, and it may have been just unfortunate that Obama was in office. It was an anger against the incumbent more than anything else. I think there was a sense that the system was unfair. Trump called it rigged, and he was right. What brought it so much out in the open was the response to the financial crisis of 2008. Where ordinary Americans saw the bankers being helped and they're losing their jobs, they're losing their homes. And it was fundamentally, I think, unfair. Obama, in his defense, said he needed to save the economy. He had to save the financial system. But he could have done it in other ways. And many of us in the progressive movement said that. And I think in this sense, we're now feeling the consequences of some of those wrong decisions. But remember, most of those policies were originally formulated by President Bush. And the crisis was caused, in some sense, by the deregulation that had begun under President Reagan and continued under President Bush. So this is not an anti-democratic party movement. It's against what is sometimes called the movement, the deliberalization, the neoliberal agenda, opening up markets without taking into full account the consequences.
Right now, there's a lot of talk about fixing the infrastructure, but didn't President Obama suggest that from the outset when he was first elected, and he couldn't get it through?
Yeah, there's so many ironies. Not only did he suggest it, he put into place some very careful controls to make sure that the money was well spent, but he was aware that we were facing an economic crisis, and he needed to get the money into the economy quickly. And that's why he focused on shovel-ready projects. What's interesting in the current discussion is everybody seems to have forgotten that discussion. If Trump is really serious about really important infrastructure, we won't be feeling the effects for 3, 4, 5 years from now. We won't have the impulse, the consequences of that on our macroeconomy felt for a long time.
Well, the part of the disagreement is how you pay for these things, and Republicans are suggesting you do it through giving tax, through the taxation system.
Yeah, and this is actually quite remarkable. Paying through it, through the taxes, is still paying for it. The question is what is the least cost way to the ordinary taxpayer? Tax credits are extraordinarily inefficient. The bang for the buck is very low. So it's actually per dollar of real infrastructure we're going to get is going to be we're not going to get a good benefit. But it's even worse right now in the current environment. The federal government can borrow at close to zero interest rate. In terms of real interest rates, even negative real interest rates, the private sector can't. And we're going to have to pay for that much higher cost of capital for the private sector. So not only are we going to have to pay through our tax system, ordinary Americans are going to have to pay through toll roads, the other ways of paying back the hedge funds who are going to be making loads of money. They're not going to do this out of charity. They're going to get a profit out of this.
My guess is Joseph Stiglitz, the Columbia University economist, Nobel laureate, his article, How the Democrats Can Fix Themselves, is in the current issue of Vanity Fair. Aren't there deep disagreements among Democrats over what needs fixing, if anything, as exemplified by Tim Ryan's challenge to Nancy Pelosi's leadership?
I actually think that some of this is more age and new blood into the system. When Ed Miliband lost the election in the UK, there was a big debate about whether he had gone too much to the right or too much to the left. Should he, as a result, should the Labour Party appeal more to, you might say, the progressive wing, or should they appeal more to the conservative? We don't have that debate, I think, in the United States, because we realize now that the big mistake was the Democrats didn't put forward as effective alternative to the right, and that's why I think it has to be a progressive agenda.
And a caller called in while we were talking to say emphatically, my staff points out, that the problem with the Democrats is that they put up a corporate candidate. Do you agree?
Well,
that was a complaint that many people on the left had about Hillary Clinton.
Well, I think she herself was not so much a corporate candidate. If you looked at the agenda that she put forward, it was very critical of the banks. It had a lot of reforms in our corporate governance that they would not have liked. It was arguing against TPP, the trade agreement. But she carried with her a lot of baggage. We have to admit that. And some of the baggage she carried with her were some of the actions which her husband had done in the Bill Clinton's administration, where we passed NAFTA, we did the financial sector deregulation, we lowered the taxes on capital gains. That was sort of the mood of the country. And he had an additional problem. He was trying to get some legislation through a Republican Congress. And he was trying to, he wanted to do something. He got worked hard to be president. He was an activist. And it was that kind of compromise which I think led to the problems that the Democratic Party has today.
What he called triangulation.
He called it triangulation, which was actually to move the Democratic Party to a little bit to the right to adopt some of the pro-business policies, including financial market deregulation, which I think was the core mistake, but also lowering capital gains tax rates. You know, I was in the Clinton administration at the time. I was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. And I said, you know, the evidence is overwhelming. Lowering capital gains tax rates will not promote savings, and it didn't, won't promote more growth and investment, and it didn't, but will lead to more inequality, which it did. Unfortunately, my views didn't prevail.
Many still blame Ralph Nader for Al Gore's loss in 2000, and some now blaming Bernie Sanders' supporters or Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate. How have progressive candidates affected the Democratic campaigns?
I think in this campaign, they've had a very positive effect. I think they've helped set the agenda. I think they really did get a lot of enthusiasm over some new ideas. You know, Bernie Sanders wasn't the candidate, but the number of people that got engaged in politics because of Bernie Sanders was enormous. I think Ralph Nader is another question, because if you think about where history would have been if the voters who in Florida who had voted for Ralph Nader had switched their vote towards Al Gore, we would have been spared the second Bush, and history would have been different.
Well, Gail Collins has an article today in which she blames Jill Stein for the loss of Michigan. Whether that's true or not is a whole other matter.
But even had the Democrats gotten Michigan, they would have lost in the Electoral College.
Democrats, including its leaders like Chuck Schumer, were rallying to support Keith Ellison, the first Muslim in Congress to be DNC chair, but President Obama and others in the administration are opposed. Why?
I'm not quite sure whether it is a sense of the Obama administration wants more continuity with what they have done and is a little bit nervous about the move of the Democratic Party towards a more progressive agenda. I think the Democratic Party needs to move towards that more progressive agenda. I think it's where the American people want. They want an alternative. The polling is very strongly that when you look not at the candidates but at the policies, they really are in support of the policies that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party has supported. So I don't know whether it's a matter of personnel, you know, the particular people, or whether they are more focused of, you might say, the continuity and continuation, not resisting some changes on the progressive side that actually cost the Democratic Party. The fact that Obama resisted these during the 8 years of his administration, I think the country is paying a high price for that.
My guest is Joseph Stiglitz. His article, How the Democrats Can Fix Themselves, is in the current issue of Vanity Fair. And we will continue our conversation after this. We are back with Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz. He is also teaches economics at Columbia University and writes regularly for Vanity Fair. The most recent article is How the Democrats Can Fix Themselves, and we have a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org/lopate. Political economist Mark Blythe has coined the term global Trumpism, and he argues that Trump's victory was predictable, was in fact predicted, and is part of a larger trend that includes the Brexit vote and the rise of nationalist conservatives in Europe. Is a change occurring across Western industrial democracies?
I think there are common forces going on. Each of the countries has their own idiosyncratic factors. But I think the common force is that what I was hinting at before was going on in the United States. There's growing inequality. There is a sense that the system is rigged. And there is growing mistrust of government. Government was supposed to fix things. It was supposed to be fair. It was supposed to help people. And in country after country, what we saw as even the center-left governments helping advance an agenda of financial market liberalization, trade liberalization, may avail it some benefits for the country as a whole, but those effects didn't trickle down. So the promises of that everybody would benefit were broken, and that's led to a great loss of trust of the elites.
Now we're talking about trickle up.
Exactly. So what we're seeing is a larger and larger fraction of GDP going to the top. Almost all the growth. One of the numbers that just is so striking in the first 3 years of our recovery in 2009 to 2012, 91% of all the gains in the economy went to the top 1%.
And that's during the Obama administration.
And that was during the Obama.
But is that because of Obama policies or just because of the political situation we have been living with?
Oh, it could have been much different had different policies been pursued. In other words, had there been an agenda that didn't just focus on saving the banks, focused more on saving ordinary Americans, I think things would have been quite different.
Mark Blythe also describes telling wealthy acquaintances the Hamptons are not a defensible position. In The Great Divide, you described wealthy people joking darkly about a return of the guillotine. If current trends continue, how much social upheaval might there be? There's been a lot of talk about potential violence if Trump lost. Do you think there will be social upheaval now that he has won?
Well, I think America in general, as these big social upheavals, protest movements, have not been part of our recent history. We have marches, but they've all been very peaceful. I think that what I said in my article in the Vanity Fair called "Of the 1%, for the 1%, and by the 1%." That's 2011. It was really anticipating much of what has happened since then. What I pointed out was it was in the interest of the 1% to have policies that were more egalitarian, in which the benefits of our growth were more widely shared. And I think what's happened since then has just reinforced the conclusions of what I said back then.
Donald Trump criticized Wall Street a lot during the campaign, but now he's turning to Goldman Sachs for top administration officials. What's your view of Wall Street's influence in Washington?
It's still going to be there. As a number of people pointed out, making fun of his promise to drain the swamp, that he's refilling the swamp faster than the water's leaving it, and he's refilling it with billionaires and those with vested interest, including his own vested interest, at a pace that we've never seen before.
In fact, his cabinet may have the highest combined worth of any in U.S. history.
And it's not just adjusted for inflation. It's not just that inflation has made those numbers bigger. The number of billionaires will be almost surely a record. The danger is not just that they had money. The danger is that they see the world through a different lens. They really don't understand either how economic systems work or how ordinary people experience lives and the hardships they face. So when they are talking about, for instance, getting rid of Obamacare, they don't really understand the problems that the millions of people who will lose insurance will face. The people who can't, who have pre-existing conditions won't be able to get insurance. They just don't understand what it's like to live on a really tight budget.
Listeners have been calling in. One wonders if the Democrats aren't radicalized enough. Right now, he says it's as if they have been castrated, and wonders if you agree.
I think there's an active debate going on, and I'm very hopeful, actually, that you might say Trump will energize not only the Democrats, but all Americans, because so many of his proposals will be so outrageous. He's talking about tax proposals and saying they're going to be fair. The numbers that have been run by independent agencies, you know, foundations looking at these are saying that 50% of the benefits or so will go to the top 1%. You know, that's, most people would say that's not a fair tax cut.
And some economists like Simon Johnson at MIT warned that the groundwork is being laid for future financial crises. Is there reason to think that financial institutions are headed for trouble again?
Very much so. I mean,
deregulation a concern?
He's argued rolling back Dodd-Frank. You know, my concern about Dodd-Frank was that it didn't go far enough and that it left the financial system exposed to too many risks. And we know what happens when you give them the opportunity to take those risks. They take those risks knowing that we'll bail them out as we did in 2008 and 2009. And Trump is talking about, and his Secretary Treasury nominee is talking about, stripping away what even the limited regulations that we passed in Dodd-Frank. So this will open up new avenues for risk-taking. We're already seeing examples of you might say, the appetite that the financial sector has for that kind of risk-taking in subprime auto loans.
But haven't others argued that risk-taking is necessary to develop a thriving economy?
There is such a thing as good risk-taking and bad risk-taking. When you're investing in technology and research, you never know what the outcome is. That's good risk-taking. When you're gambling, speculating, and the winner is the private sector and the loser is the American taxpayer, when you're putting at risk the entire American economy, knowing that the government was going to pick up the bill, that's unproductive risk-taking.
And what Wells Fargo is accused of doing was not risk-taking.
That was not risk-taking. That was just pure exploitation. Opening accounts.
But nobody will go to jail, I suspect.
I think that's right. Just like very few people went to jail after 2008 and 2009. You know, many fewer people went to jail after 2008 and 2009 than the much smaller financial crisis that we had, the S&L crisis, in the late 80s. And that, of course, provides an even more encouraging environment for this kind of predatory and exploitive behavior that the financial sector has perfected and which they will do more and more of if we strip away the Dodd-Frank, which has constrained some of the worst behaviors, which includes a office that tries to stop the worst behavior, consumer exploitation, and many of the Republicans are pushing for stripping that away so that the banks can get really back in business exploiting ordinary Americans.
Given all the talk, including by politicians, about the harm of big money in politics, how likely is it that either party will move to change their dependence on huge donors?
I think it's become a central platform of the Democratic Party that we need financial reform. And there are many wealthy people who really believe that even though they recognize that they can have more influence through their money, they think it is really bad for our democracy. And I think I have to commend the large number of wealthy Americans who have said this is undermining our democracy. So I think there is, especially in the Democratic Party, a strong movement to restrain the influence of money in politics. And, you know, other democracies have done it. You know, it's not, you might say, well, won't that inhibit free speech? That's nonsense. Every other democracy has found ways of restraining the influence of money better than we have.
And one way many have done it is by shortening the election season. We tend to have the longest election season in the world.
That's right.
Which means that money is needed constantly if you're starting a presidential campaign 2 years out or more.
That's right. So that's one way of doing it. There are other ways. I think having what the Australian system, where everybody is required to vote or at least go to the voting booth, takes away this incentive for trying to make sure, spending so much money to get your friends to vote and doing all you can to keep everybody else from voting. When you make it an economic penalty, you make it a social for not voting, and you make it a social norm to vote, then you get everybody out there, and then you get a more representative view of what policies are good for the country. And I think when that happens, the Democrats will win overwhelmingly, which is why there's been such efforts by the Republicans to engage in disenfranchisement.
But there's also the whole matter of class consciousness. For a long time, the Democrats were seen as the party of the working poor, the working people, Republicans of the wealthy. During this last election, it seemed to have flopped. The Democrats are seen rather as the party of elites and promoters of meritocracy. And Donald Trump was talking about the forgotten American worker.
And that's why the progressive agenda that I talk about is so important. It reconnects the Democratic Party with its roots. We don't use necessarily the word working class. You know, most Americans are working. What I've emphasized is our economic system isn't working for the bottom 90%. So it's not just a small class of Americans. It's the vast majority of Americans that are finding it hard to achieve, you might call it, the basic constituents of a decent living standard. And that's what the progressive agenda needs to focus on.
Well, what happens if Trump and the Republicans fail to act to benefit people in the areas that voted strongly for Trump? How likely is it that those people will vote for change? Haven't rural conservative areas voted for the Republicans despite Republican economic policies, as Tom Frank has written about for years now?
Now, it may be that eventually they learn what is in their interest. And I think it took a long time for some of the discontent that I had expected with growing inequality to manifest itself. But you have to remember, it is still the case that the vast majority of Americans live in urban areas. So what is, if we can get the urban voters out...
They come out? Aren't they the ones who voted overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton? It just the Electoral College gives added weight to the rural vote.
But they didn't come out strong enough. If they had come out in the strength that many people had anticipated, then Hillary would have won even more overwhelmingly in terms of the popular vote than she did.
Harvard economist Gregory Mankiw once said, quote, "Smart parents make more money and pass those good genes on to their offspring." And a former colleague of Steve Bannon says that he talked about, quote, "the genetic superiority of some people," and once mused about the desirability of limiting the vote to property owners. I guess that would be a return to the early 19th century. Do the elite believe that they are naturally or innately superior?
Well, I think some may, but that really undermines the basic tenets of American democracy, and I think democracies around the world. I think the inequality that we see is fundamentally because of the intergenerational transmission of advantage. They get to go to better schools. They get to have all, you know, internships that the less advantaged don't have. We have a university college system that is provides less opportunity than almost any of the other advanced countries. So that's why we're winding up with much greater inequality than other countries.
And you teach at an elite university. Do you find that your students are sophisticated about economic matters?
Increasingly so, but...
Because I was wondering how well the public understands economic issues.
Well, I think there isn't, one of the reasons I spend so much time writing is to increase our understanding. But I want to come back to Columbia is an elite university, but it makes a great effort to open its doors to everybody. So it has, like most of the other, some of the better schools in the country, what they call Nigs Blind Admissions. People get admitted regardless of the economic background. And it actually, and then they look at how much the student needs to go to the college. So there's no economic barrier. But the problem is, even with all that opportunity, because our elementary and secondary school system is so inegalitarian, so unfair, it is still the case that a very relatively small percentage of our student body comes from the bottom 50%, as hard as we try.
Do you think that journalists are doing a good job in explaining economic issues?
Not as good a job as they should. I think that too often there's a repeating of, you might call it, the conventional wisdom. And for a long time, that conventional wisdom was based on trickle-down economics, you know, just free up markets, liberalized financial markets, the economy was going to grow, everybody would benefit. And I'm sure if you went through the op-eds, the editorials that have been written over the last 25 years, you would see that theme repeated over and over again.
Despite the fact that many people felt it failed during the Reagan administration.
It failed very starkly during the Reagan administration. And then the question was, well, let's give it a better chance. Time, you know, it's just began. And now the point is we have a third of a century of evidence on whether that, you know, sometimes called supply-side economics, neoliberal economics. We have a third of a century of experiment of rewriting the rules of the market economy in ways that we're supposed to free it up and incentivize it, and we see the consequence of this experiment. And we can't say, well, just give it, you know, things are going to turn the corner. We now can say definitively, this is a failed experiment. We need to try something different, which is why I think this progressive agenda, rewriting the rules of the American economy once again to make sure that things are fairer, that they're not stacked for the corporate interest. I think this agenda is really one that the American people will buy.
Joseph Stiglitz is teaches economics at Columbia University. He is a Nobel laureate, and he writes regularly for Vanity Fair. His most recent column, How the Democrats Can Fix Themselves. We have a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate. Thank you for being on our show again.
Oh,
it's always
a
pleasure.
A real pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.